You're listening to UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell, and this is The Smartest Doctor in the Room, where real medicine meets real answers. Each episode, I bring you honest conversations with some of the brightest minds in health and medicine. Let's get started. Toxic mold exposure in the home is dangerous to your health. I see patients every week in my practice who are suffering from the effects of toxic mold. And in many cases, they were living in a home where they didn't even know mold was present. That's why I recommend to patients who suspect they are ill, possibly from toxic mold exposure, to obtain a test from Immunolytics, a company that specializes in mold detection with simple mold plates for your home or office. The mold plates are put in various rooms of your home and then left open for an hour. They are then closed up and you observe them for 5 days. If the mold plates show growth, you can send them back to Immunolytics and the company will analyze them and interpret the results for you. Please see the link in the show notes to order your mold plates from Immunolytics and use the code Smartest Doc to get a 5% discount. Today's topic is one that confuses women and doctors alike. It is the question on whether hormone replacement therapy, HRT, is safe and beneficial for women in menopause. You know, and this is where the roller coaster ride of confusion occurs. And it's really the fault of the medical establishment for what's gone on over the past 25 years. So just to set the stage, in the early 2000s, the Women's Health Initiative did a large randomized clinical trial to see if hormonal therapy would prevent diseases such as heart disease or breast cancer. Surprisingly, the trial reported that taking hormonal treatments actually increased both of these diseases. So understandably, gynecologists were telling their patients, stop the female hormones like estrogen and progesterone, and they basically left the women to suffer with the symptoms of menopause. But in retrospect, an important caveat to these results: the WHI study did have some significant flaws. It recruited women that were sometimes many years beyond menopause, even some women up to 79 years of age. And of course, these women were naturally at a greater risk for cancer and heart disease based on age alone. It's interesting, the younger women in the study, around age 50 or so in the trial, did not have the same risk for heart disease or breast cancer. Also of considerable importance, we're going to get into this today, the only women that saw an increase in breast cancer were taking a synthetic version of the hormone progesterone. Now, new studies are showing something different. Women who are started on hormonal therapy within 10 years of menopause and using bioidentical hormones are having a better quality of life and actually a decrease in heart disease and cancer. So the ride has come like almost full circle, yet doctors and women are still reluctant due to the past information. My guest today is Dr. Jillian Goddard. She is an endocrinologist, not a gynecologist, which we're going to get into. I think it's important. She's also an adjunct assistant professor at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine and the author of the new book, The Hormone Loop, which is going to be released June 2nd, probably by the time this podcast comes out. I think she just might be the right person to set the record straight. So I'm really pleased to welcome Dr. Jillian Goddard to the podcast.
I'm really delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. So let's first get into your background a little bit. Actually, I saw that you also, undergrad, you majored in journalism, which I think kind of gives you a little bit of extra edge in helping you communicate. But you are an endocrinologist. Now, Dr. Goddard, I just want to ask you, you know, I know when my background's in internal medicine, and I ended up specializing in immunology, allergy, and holistic medicine. But again, I remember back in the day, the endocrinologists, and a lot of them I see even in New York, they typically are associated with treating thyroid disease, diabetes, sometimes the rare pituitary or adrenal conditions. What led you to focus on female hormonal treatment?
Hi, everyone. I know you may already know from listening to my podcast that I specialize in treating patients with toxic mold exposure. It's become a serious problem for many years as we deal with the hurricanes and floods throughout the country. You know, even simple bathroom water leaks from a toilet in your home over time can contribute to mold buildup. I can help patients that suffer from the symptoms of toxic mold, but I also rely on the patients getting their current residents inspected so they are not continually being exposed. My go-to person for mold exposure is Joe Reese. Joe is a certified mold inspector with decades of experience. He is super thorough and gives you a straightforward assessment and tells you whether it's safe to live in your home or if there is mold. I should know, I used Joe when I moved to my new home 4 years ago. Fortunately, when I moved in, I smelled an unusual odor in my basement and I immediately called Joe. He came over with his instruments and he found the problem. Afterwards, I had remediation and the problem was solved. Joe does inspections all throughout the country. He welcomes calls to his cell phone at 908-451-4592. You can also reach him by email at jprconsultants7929@gmail.com. Remember, mold in your home is not a good thing, but thankfully it's a problem that can be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really a couple of things. One is that those pivotal studies that came out about the Women's Health Initiative actually came out while I was in medical school. And so that definitely sparked an interest for me. But also, I was a young woman going through my reproductive life as I was going through med school and residency and fellowship. And I really was interested in the ways in which women's bodies are different and the ways in which women's bodies are different that we don't understand. And importantly, that a lot of that literature comes out of the endocrinology space specifically. So.
Interesting. Okay. Which is interesting too. Sometimes that people may think it's strange to get into this, but typically, again, until recently too, endocrinology was a very male dominated, you know, specialty, like a lot of other internal medicine specialties. I mean, now women are making up more than 50% of the medical school classes. This is all going to change. But yeah, who would know better than a woman? And again, I really think coming from the endocrine perspective versus just being a gynecologist is extremely important. You know, not to get into really a turf battle, but do you think that more endocrinologists should be, you know, when a woman says, you know, I need help with menopause, they should be seeing an endocrinologist versus just their gynecologist? Because again, the gynecologist is really sort of their primary care, quote, physician, you know, and a lot of times it's their only physician in some cases.
I think this is a really interesting question. And I think it's helpful to understand the differences between an endocrinologist and a gynecologist and sort of the overlaps, because you and I both know there's lots of areas of medical specialty where there is overlap. And so Right. Then the question becomes like, who does what?
Yeah. And, you know, just addressing that, you know, I'll give you just a quick example too, you know, just to stir some controversy. Like in one of my areas of my specialty, like an allergy, you know, I would treat a lot of sinus issues. So do otolaryngologists, ENTs, but it's very interesting, the approach, you know, the ENTs being surgeons, a lot of it's surgical. I try to protect my patients from surgeries. I try to find out what's their underlying exposures. So again, that's why I'm bringing it up. It really caught my eye when I was reading the article in the New York Times, you know, about your book, you know, that again, and you were the title reading, my patient finally got relief on her hot flashes. I was probably expecting a gynecologist to be writing that. So I was kind of like a little bit pleasantly surprised when I said, this is an endocrinologist. I know they consider also the thinking doctors, like infectious disease, right? That was just for the insiders, you know, to know. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about your book, The Hormone Loop.
Yeah.
Okay? And I was going through, it's very impressive. Look, I wrote a book this past year myself, only Concrete Candida, and I know how much work goes into writing a book. At the end, it's like you don't even want to look at it anymore. It's read it so many times, but it is an important, I think it's a huge accomplishment for anyone because of the work, the research you have to do. So why did you set out to write the book?
Yeah, I think that the reason this book was so important to me was because, kind of like what we were talking before about how medicine gets a little siloed, when the way we talk about women's hormonal health gets very siloed. We talk about puberty, we talk about pregnancy, we talk about perimenopause and menopause, and it's as though like all the spaces in between don't exist. But in reality, all of these different stages of a woman's life move together, all these different stages overlap, and there are commonalities among them. And so understanding how the different stages fit together can be really helpful. The other piece of things is that there's only 9,000 endocrinologists in the entire country. And many of them are concentrated in the coasts. New York is chock-a-block full, but if you're not on the coast, you may not have easy access to an endocrinologist. That means that women really have to understand their own hormonal health so that they can have better conversations with their doctors. I would love it if every woman could see an endocrinologist to talk about, any of these specific transitions in their reproductive lives. Unfortunately, the reality is many women won't have access to an endocrinologist.
The station that makes you feel good. What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So
You know, it's interesting you say that because, I've found in my own experience too, it's crazy. Now, endocrinology, again, just for our listeners, is not a procedure specialty, kind of like, internal medicine. And unfortunately, what's happened in the dynamics of medicine, a lot of, to be able to stay, be able to practice, they're part of hospital groups, or hospitals. And unfortunately, with that, I'll typically hear when I refer a patient even to Columbia Presbyterian, let's say if it was like an unusual pituitary case that I wanted. They'll tell me it's 4 months to be seen. I
At
mean, I hope the
least.
patient's alive by then,
Yeah,
So,
at least. I
yeah,
mean, many
so that's, you're right.
endocrinologists
That's a
have long
real,
waits.
stopgap for these patients, and limiting their, possibility of seeing a specialist to help them. Can you maybe describe a little bit too, again, it's probably somewhat common knowledge for the women who are in menopause, but what is the symptoms and what's actually happening? Like, why are they getting poor sleep, weight gain, all that kind of stuff that really is concerning?
Yeah, absolutely. I think let's start with why it's happening,
Okay.
because it informs sort of the symptoms that women have. So, girls are born with all of the eggs that they will ever have. And over the course of our reproductive lives, from puberty when we begin ovulating through menopause, we sort of work our way through this pool of eggs. We start, and as we get into our latter 30s in some case, early 40s in others, the numbers of eggs that we have left in our ovaries start to dwindle. As a result, our pituitary gland has to work harder to get the ovaries to mature an egg and ovulate. And that means that estrogen levels get turned up as well. And we end up on this roller coaster of estrogen levels that are rising and falling, sometimes even at the same times that they would in earlier in our reproductive lives, but much higher and then much lower. As the eggs dwindle further, we don't ovulate every month, our periods become irregular, and eventually we run out of eggs and we have our last menstrual period. What happens during that time is not, we often talk about menopause as being sort of like our estrogen levels also drop to nothing. But that's not what happens first. What happens first is our estrogen levels are like, the craziest roller coaster at the amusement park. And it is the fluctuation, and this is true of endocrinology in general, but it is the fluctuation of hormones that lead to symptoms, not the
That's a great
actual levels
point. That's a great
themselves.
point. Maybe is that what the hormone loop stands for? I don't know. It seems to make sense, but okay, that's a great point. So, because when we get into treatment, I think that's going to help people understand. So this fluctuation that's happening, is that what causes the hot flashes, the insomnia,
It is.
and even the
So
weight gain?
the weight gain is a little bit different, and we'll talk about that. But hot flushes, night sweats, sleep disruption are often related to these big swings in hormone levels. The weight gain is really probably much more complex than that. Certainly, dropping estrogen allows women to gain weight in their midsection. Estrogen tells us to store fat in our hips and thighs. Without the estrogen, we store it in our midsection.
If you've been following the podcast, you may know I practice holistic functional medicine and immunology. In fact, at Mitchell Medical Group, we've been treating chronic fatigue patients for 3 decades. It's critical in this work to have a trusted pharmacy that can compound medications for our sensitive patients' needs. ITC Pharmacy has been our go-to pharmacy the entire time. They can make medications ranging from thyroid hormones to dye-free medications for all of our highly sensitive, even allergic patients. If you or your holistic doctor are looking for these very specific patient medications, you can contact ITC at 888-349-5453. They have licenses throughout the country and can have medications delivered right to your doorsteps. My patients have been so pleased with their service, and you will be too.
So then we become a little bit insulin resistant. Insulin tells us we want carbs. It tells us to store those carbohydrates as fat in our midsection. So we become more insulin resistant and we end up in this vicious cycle. However, there's some really interesting research that's just starting to come out that's looking at another hormone, follicle stimulating hormone. So that hormone is made in our pituitary gland and it actually tells our ovaries to mature an egg and it tells our ovaries to make estrogen. So, one of the things that happens in perimenopause and menopause is that FSH levels get very, very high. They don't know that, like, our pituitary gland doesn't know that there's no eggs left to ovulate. And so it keeps making FSH in an effort to get that ovulation to occur. However, for a long time, we thought FSH just acts in the ovaries and nowhere else. But it turns out there's FSH receptors in other places. And critically, there's FSH receptors in our adrenal glands. And while we don't fully understand what FSH is doing there, we think it may be causing some changes in hormone levels like mineralocorticoids, and cortisol, which affect things like blood pressure, weight, and
Very
mood.
interesting.
But that science is fairly new, and we've got a lot of work to do there yet.
All right, let's get into the question of the day. When is hormonal replacement therapy, HRT, appropriate and when is it not? Now, it seems to be from what they're saying now, and you mentioned in your book and the article, that there seems to be a window in time when a woman enters menopause when HRT is appropriate. So maybe you could give us an idea. Is it within 5 years, the latest 10 years? Who's too old for HRT?
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, what's interesting about this conversation is that we're really seeing a shift in how we think about this idea as we speak. And so the conversation is really shifting away. You know, after the Women's Health Initiative, we said, if you absolutely cannot tolerate your menopause symptoms, you can have hormone therapy as long as you're under age 60, and you can take it for not more than 5 years. And that conversation is really starting to shift a little. There is...
Can you give me a sample? What was that parameter for? Where did they come up with this? And like, and why not more than 5 years? Because then they thought the risk-benefit ratio changes?
Yeah. So when they looked at the data in the Women's Health Initiative study, they saw that the risk of breast cancer in particular started to rise when women had been on hormone therapy for about 5 years. And so that was sort of the thinking around this idea of 5 years. But what ended up happening is women were kind of like white knuckling it through symptoms to wait till their symptoms got bad enough, because they knew that they'd get their estrogen patch and, you know, 5 years later, somebody was going to like take away their prescription, whether they might still benefit from it or not. And so where we've sort of landed now is that we should think about the benefits of treating perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms and the downsides of treating for each individual woman. And so what that means is that someone might start hormone therapy before their last menstrual period. You do not have to be in menopause to start hormone therapy. And we might find that for some women, starting hormone therapy after age 60, cautiously and with appropriate monitoring, might also be okay depending on the symptoms that woman is having and her individual risk factors for breast cancer and heart disease.
What are the goals with HRT? Is it symptomatic relief? Is it preventing, you know, the complications of the change in the hormones of osteoporosis or cardiovascular disease? Like, again, like what goes through your mind, your checklist?
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question. You have a 50-year-old woman comes into you. She's been having the hot flashes. She's uncomfortable, insomnia, etc. Still has her uterus. Maybe we'll get into that. And asks you, you know, is hormonal replacement therapy right for me?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing that you said is that she's having hot flushes, night sweats, and sleep disruption. And the reason that is important is because estrogen is the most effective treatment for vasomotor symptoms, bar none. It is incredibly effective, and 80% of women will have vasomotor symptoms at some point during the perimenopausal transition. So then I'm thinking, estrogen is going to be the best treatment for her symptoms, what are her risk factors? And really, at this point, unless she has active cardiovascular disease, which is very unusual in a 50-year-old woman, and we can talk about why that is, or she has a personal history of estrogen-positive breast cancer or a high-risk estrogen-positive lesion, those are really the only situations in which we recommend against using estrogen to treat those symptoms at this point. Now,
I'm sorry, what did you say? You said you would be against it. Why again in this in the patient?
The only reasons we would be against using estrogen would be if someone had active cardiovascular disease or a personal history of estrogen positive.
Oh, interesting.
Breast cancer.
Okay. Okay. Do you also check lab tests? I mean, is that important to have some baseline levels? Some doctors don't. I feel like it would be.
Yeah.
I don't think you'd want to.
I think in certain situations it can be quite helpful. More and more we're seeing women who come, they're in their 50s, they're symptomatic, but they have progestin-eluting IUDs, for example. And so they don't have periods. They don't know if their periods are regular. And
right.
In that situation, baseline labs can be incredibly helpful. And so there are situations in which I will consider checking labs. What gets tricky is particularly in perimenopausal women, labs can be very variable. And so even if we're getting like day three labs after a period, which is supposed to be the like most reliable time to check hormones like FSH and estrogen, they can vary quite wildly from, you know, from one lab test to the next. And so I tend not to check labs unless there's a really specific question I'm looking to answer.
I'd like to take a moment to let my listeners know that my new book, Conquering Candida, is now available on Amazon in paperback and ebook. If you believe you suffer from Candida, this is the first book in 50 years since the original book, The Yeast Connection by Dr. William Crook, to give credence to this underdiagnosed an undertreated condition. If you also want to understand gut health and the microbiome, I also believe you will enjoy this book. I do appreciate if you read this book to rate it on Amazon and provide your comments and a review.
Yeah. What about, I think you was mentioned in the article, you had a patient that basically had a chemical hysterectomy because she had had cancer and had chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. What's your decision? And I think in this case, you actually went ahead and you said it was okay to prescribe. So what is your, the line you don't want to cross when you're deciding that HRT is contraindicated? Is it a specific kind of cancer, like if a BRCA positive or somebody's had like a lymphoma? I'm just curious. Or
yeah, I think that this is where it's really important to get on the phone with our colleagues. because the oncologist is the specialist in the particular and knows the most detail about the specific cancer that the patient had.
Oh,
in this
okay.
case, this patient had a colorectal cancer.
Colorectal, right.
And so in that case, the chemotherapy can damage the ovaries and lead to menopause. But the cancer itself is not necessarily specifically
like estrogen receptive or whatever.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly.
Good point.
And
yeah.
There are exceptions to that rule because certain,
okay.
cancer syndromes can also include breast cancer risk.
Do you find the oncologists are knowledgeable enough or they should be, because this becomes a very important discussion for the patient. And I understand you wanting to defer to some degree to the oncologist because nobody wants to, God forbid, die from cancer. So is that the tricky part?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the art of medicine as opposed to the science, right? Like, we're talking about, in this case, we were talking about quite a young woman. She was only in her late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about not, there is evidence that women in that age range benefit from a reduction in risk for cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis, because that is a very early menopause, regardless of its cause. But I find that when we actually get on the phone, when we actually have a conversation with our colleagues, we can get into some of the nuance and talk about the individual a little bit in a little bit more of a nuanced way, than if we, I don't know, send my chart messages back and forth to each other, or just put the patient, quite frankly, in the middle of the conversation and have them running back and forth with information. So,
Is there any special way that you would have to monitor a patient like that or any of them that you could, I mean, is it kind of like, set it and forget it? You put them on the hormones, I'll see you in a year, 2 years. Or is it like, okay, you need to have, I don't know, like an ultrasound of your, if a woman has a uterus or something, check the lining, whatever. What happens in that case?
yeah, in most cases, as long as we're managing the symptoms, which is the biggest question, are we effectively doing what we're hoping to do with the hormone therapy? In most cases, then we would be basing our decision on that. But there are situations in which we would, want imaging, where we would might want to increase the rate at which we check in with someone with an office visit or with labs. But for most women, it really is a man about managing symptoms and
Right.
not necessarily hitting certain target like ranges, or something like that.
But you would get, would you get a baseline like ultrasound of their uterus or no,
Not
not
if
necessarily?
they're not necessarily.
No, okay.
Yeah, not necessarily.
Okay. All right, let's get to what people are really also very interested in, the types of hormonal therapy. And
Yeah.
I'm really going to rely on your expertise to discuss this. I mean, there's oral estrogen, there's transdermal estrogen, there's bioidentical hormones and synthetic hormones, and maybe hopefully we're going to get to the micronized
Yeah.
progesterone. And, the
Yeah.
way I explain it to patients, because I'm not an expert, but I tell them
Yeah.
what I understand, my simplistic knowledge of this was that back in the day, a lot of the hormones were gotten from a horse, like urine or something. It was obviously synthetic. It was much more powerful than the bioidentical, which I think are plant-based and more closer to real human hormones, surprisingly. So maybe take us through that, the different
Sure.
options.
Sure. So our initial hormone therapy was in fact something called conjugated equine estrogen, which was estrogen isolated from the urine of pregnant horses. And it was typically combined. So the combination that they used in the Women's Health Initiative, for example, was combined with medroxyprogesterone, which is a synthetic progesterone. There's a couple of things that I think are help where there's a couple of things where when we kind of get into the details of the different hormones, it can get a little confusing because there's our scientific language and then there's sort of colloquial language. In the years after the Women's Health Initiative study, people started talking about bioidentical hormones. And when they were talking about that, they were often referring to a combination of hormones that was made in a compounded cream in a compounding pharmacy. Now we have estradiol, which comes in patches and gels. And that estradiol is derived from plant
You would call that
sources,
bioidentical.
but
You
it's
would.
by it is because it's identical to the estrogen that women
Okay.
make in their ovaries, which is the real technical definition of what bioidentical is. So now we like to use bioidentical hormones when we can, but the piece in the New York Times, I was talking about the fact that estrogen patches are experiencing a significant shortage. And so women aren't able to necessarily get estrogen patches. And so we are rethinking on an individual level who can take what types of estrogen. We also
The
have
estrogen is not going through the Strait of Hormuz, right? That's not the
no,
problem.
no, no, no. The problem is that the number of prescriptions written for estradiol patches
Really
has
went up.
increased 86% in the last few years, and the manufacturers have not apparently
Kept
felt the
up with this
need
demand,
to. Yeah.
surprisingly, because
You
you'd
would think
think.
they'd want to sell more drug, but it's not as straightforward as it seems.
So, and one of the things which I think is quite important, it's kind of confusing that Like for estrogen, from what I understand, it's better to do it on the skin, like either transdermal or gels. Whereas progesterone, you can still do orally, but it's not a good idea to do oral estrogen. Why is that?
Well, it's not so much that it's not a good idea. And we do have oral estrogens. The challenge with oral estrogen is twofold. One is hormones in general don't do well in the gastrointestinal tract. They get broken down by
Right.
the stomach
By the
acid.
stomach acid, right.
And so we have to give bigger doses of estrogen. We
Ah.
have bioidentical
Aha.
estradiol in pill form, but we have to give bigger doses.
Right.
The other thing that happens is that when we take something orally, the first place it goes is into the circulation that goes to our liver. And
Right.
our liver actually modifies some of this estrogen into metabolites. And then
Aha.
all of that gets into our circulation.
Yeah.
For women who have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease or who have a higher risk of clotting, of forming blood clots,
Right.
oral estrogens can increase that risk. When we give estradiol through the skin, we can give smaller doses and it doesn't pass through the liver first. And so we don't see that same increased risk for blood clots and cardiovascular disease.
That's really important stuff, and you're making me flip back to something to for our younger listeners. A lot of the women that are on birth control pill, would they be better off with some type of device or something versus taking an oral pill? Because I mean, I know they're younger, but that still would put them at all the risks that you're talking about, correct?
So it's interesting. This was a concern, particularly in women over age 35 when the birth control pill was first developed in the 50s and 60s. But it's important to note that the first birth control pills were in had much, much higher doses of estrogen than modern birth control pills do. They
Okay.
often had north of 50 micrograms of estradiol in them. And women before menopause are at extremely low risk for cardiovascular disease.
Right.
And add to that that in the 50s and 60s, many, many, many women were smokers. Smoking
Right.
increases your risk for blood
Right. So you
clots.
start getting more risk factors, sure.
So we used to say that if you were over 35, you shouldn't take a birth control pill anymore. And if you were over 35 and a smoker, you should stop your birth control pill. Today, with modern pills and the fact that, very few women are smoking, which is a great thing, we actually say you can continue taking birth control pills all the way up to the typical age of menopause, so early 50s.
Wow.
Unless you are particularly predisposed to blood clots and there are genetic
Yeah.
clotting
Right. So
issues
the
and
markers you can check for that. What about testosterone for women? I'm seeing more and more women are asking about it. I see them on it. Do you think it was
It's
overlooked before? Do you think it's a good idea for some women?
I think yes, it was overlooked. It was overlooked because we don't even today fully understand what testosterone does in women's bodies. The one thing we know is it seems to be important for sexual function, for libido and arousal, but even that we don't understand very
Yeah.
well. So that is actually the only setting in which testosterone is studied in women. The only setting in which we've studied testosterone in women is for sexual function. And
All right. So you
so,
would say if somebody had osteoporosis or
yeah,
I was very weak, you wouldn't, there's no data.
there's no data. That doesn't mean that we might learn in the future that it would be
Right.
helpful, but it means that right now the reason to take testosterone as a woman is for sexual function.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's going on right now, in addition to this idea that testosterone is like the thing that'll put a spring in your step and a glint in your eye, is that women are, in many cases, taking it in high doses, doses
No,
that get their levels up
that's
similar to
crazy. I see with
men.
men, sometimes they're injecting and getting very, even older guys were getting very high levels and they're getting clots and cardiovascular issues. And And they're going for phlebotomies because they're getting such iron overload.
Exactly, exactly. And so I always tell women our goal for testosterone is really just to bring it into the typical range for a woman.
Is it a controlled substance at very low
It
doses? It
is.
is,
It
so
is. It is. And in
interesting.
fact, there's not a formulation of testosterone that is approved in doses for women. So women really only have two options. One is to parse out a tenth of a man's dose on a daily basis, which is doable, but can be kind of a pain in the behind. And the other option is really to rely on compounding
The
pharmacies,
compounding.
which is fraught with issues because compounding pharmacies are not monitored by the
Yeah,
FDA.
they're not really
So,
standardized. I mean, you really need a good
yeah.
company to do it.
Yep. And it's hard for consumers to know which is a good compounding
Yeah.
pharmacy and which isn't.
Are there any herbal supplements that have a place in menopause treatment? I have like a lot of these women, what's it called? I'm forgetting. There's a couple of these,
There's
I don't know if it's
like
primrose oil or
the
some of this.
soy phytoestrogens, there's one, black cohosh.
Black cohosh. Do they do anything?
So there is some short-term small studies that show that they do reduce hot flushes and night sweats. They are not nearly as effective as prescription options. And I think that the really important thing to realize about this is that they do have a compound in them called isoflavones, which is what makes them effective, we think, because but it also means that if you're someone who shouldn't take estrogen, say because you have a history of estrogen positive breast cancer, you shouldn't take black cohosh either because those
That's a good
isoflavones
point.
act in the same way that estrogen does at the
What about
estrogen
soy?
receptor.
They always say that soy can raise estrogen. Is that a
Yeah.
similar issue?
Yeah, same idea.
If you eat a lot of soy or drink soy milk a lot or
Yeah. I
whatever.
mean, you would have to consume a lot of
Lots,
soy,
yeah.
but like bricks and bricks of tofu.
Okay.
So, but it's the same issue is that it's not raising estrogen, it's that there's these estrogen-like compounds in the plants. That's where
Body,
we get
yeah.
our prescription
You I
estrogen,
know,
right?
right? It seems to all make sense. Nature is,
Yeah.
has a lot of unity in it.
Yeah.
As we're kind of finishing up, two things. Dr.
Yeah.
Goddard, if you could erase one misconception for women about HRT, what would it be?
I think that the biggest misconception is that there is no, is that if you have any risk factors for breast cancer, that you shouldn't take hormone therapy. And that just has not been borne out in the literature.
Okay. All right. That's really important. And I think we give a lot of women some peace of mind. And again, I hope they please discuss this with their doctor, possibly an endocrinologist if they can get into one. And Dr. Goddard, where could patients find you if they're interested in your work?
Sure, absolutely. So I write a weekly Substack called The Savvy Patient,
Yes.
and you can find me there. I am also at The Savvy Patient on Instagram, and my practice is in New York City, and I'm happy to see people.
That's great. Well, I think a lot of them will be very interested in this. Again, her book is The Hormone Loop. I highly recommend it, especially for any woman that's got a lot of questions about their hormonal health. It's just really thorough. So again, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me here on UK Health Radio. I'm Dr. Dean Mitchell. If today's conversation was useful to you, please share it with someone who could benefit. You can find every episode of The Smartest Doctor in the Room wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay well.